The juice cook threads the dunes back of the sands, her daddy's car, but he will understand that parties must be seized, she says, like days, thrown as handmade pots, agreed the way they've signed their surfboards, waxed them down like documents.
You're listening to a Scottish Poetry Library podcast.
Hello, this is Jennifer Williams, Programme Manager at the Scottish Poetry Library, and I am honoured to be sitting with the poet Brian Johnston. You probably will have heard of him if you're from around here anyway. Brian Johnston is a Scottish poet born in Edinburgh in 1950, but who has lived in Fife since 1972. A well-known figure on the Scottish poetry scene, he is a published poet with 6 collections to his name, an event organizer of broad experience, a performer who has performed really all over the world, as far as I can tell, in many different places internationally and in the UK. He's collaborated extensively with artists and musicians, and thankfully started some very important long-standing literary events, including the Shore Poets and, in fact, Stanza, Scotland's International Poetry Festival. So we're very grateful to Brian for all that, and hope we'll get to talk to him a bit about how some of that came about. And since 1972, he has been married to the wonderful artist and printmaker Jean Johnston. So we're going to start out today with a poem. Brian's just got this beautiful new book out with ARC called Dry Stone Work, so that's what we're going to be reading from and talking about primarily today. And he's going to begin with a poem for us. So, Brian, hand over to you.
Thanks, Jennifer. I thought I'd start with this poem called Concrete Poem. I won't be able to convince you of this because you can't see it, but it's not a concrete poem. It's a poem about concrete. Concrete Poem. The ghosts of men who haunt this track won't fade the way their footprints in the dust are driven off by wind or rain. For men it surely was, whose urgent need to get to fields and flocks trumped every sign for drying concrete, drove their boots and trucks across the still to set but hardening surface of the past. A past where traces of a shovel or a rake are secrets held in stasis a roadman might detect, while others see just shadows, creases in the finish of the road, unlike those flagrant tire tracks scrawled from gate to gate, or these deep scores that tell of grasping far too late that one man's truck had sunk up to its axle in the stuff, sloughed in the footprints of his rescuers, and this past, this one deed imprinted in the place, as clear as time will print its passing in a face.
Thank you. That poem seems like a great one to start with because it feels to me that it contains one of the strong themes in the book, which seems to me very much about this temporal existence that we have and time and history and all the implications of that. But it's also, I think you said, it's one of the Greek poems in the book, isn't it?
That's right, yes. I chose to start with it precisely for those reasons, because it's the passage of time, the way the past is always present, that's something of an obsession of mine. It's something that was very much a theme that ran through my last book. But also, it is a poem set in Greece. It's set on Crete. It's about a very, very specific little piece of concrete road at the far eastern end of Crete, at the little village of Katozakros, which is one of my retreats, certainly my major retreat in Greece, place I go to a lot. A lot of this book was written there, and every time I walk from the place we're staying down to the tavernas, I walk across this little scenario set into the concrete, and it was irresistible to write about, really.
That we were talking on the way here about the Scottish referendum and identity and the places you choose to live and make your home and the places you go to on holiday. And has it been the weather that's attracted you to Greece, the people there, the history?
Yes. All of those.
The food, the wine,
the countryside. Greece is a wee bit of an obsession of mine as well. It's a country I love dearly. I pompously think of it as almost like a second homeland, although I have no right to claim that at all. I can barely speak Greek to save myself, and it's really only taverna and bus station Greek that I can say a few words in. But I do love the place. I particularly love Crete, which is like a micro continent in its own right. It's got such a variety of landscape. It's a brilliant place for walking, eating, swimming, drinking, conversing, making friends, listening to music, enjoying the weather, etc. And the place that we discovered about 7 or 8 years ago, Zakros, is such a wonderfully remote part of the island, so completely unspoiled and so quiet and peaceful. It's really conducive. I've done a lot of writing there. I wrote quite a lot of the poems. All but one of the circus poems in the new book, for example, were written there, and quite a lot of the ones that are in the other topics in the book were written there. The previous year I was working on a memoir that I'm still in the middle of writing, and wrote a great deal of that, the second draft of that, at Zakros as well. So it's a creative place also.
Do you find that being away helps you look back on your life here in Scotland? Does it give you that sense of perspective?
I wouldn't say it's that, really. It's more the fact that there are no interruptions at all. The place we stay is a tiny little isolated cottage, and I can't even check emails or anything like that. I have to go up to the studio
by
a friend
like
of ours. So no internet, no mobile phone, no television, no radio, nothing but the sound of the cicadas and the birds, and total peace and quiet. There isn't even a road past this house. You have to climb up a little mountain path to get to it, so nobody goes past it. It's just completely isolated and nothing to get in the way of contacting the creative side of yourself.
Well, this book, it's got a very interesting structure. It seems to be in, is it about five sections?
Four sections.
Was that choice to separate those poems in that way, was that specifically thematic, or did that exist before the poems, or when you were putting the manuscript together?
Well, I really owe a big thank you to John Blendy for this.
Oh.
John very kindly agreed to look over this manuscript in a very early form, several years ago now, and it was John who came up with this idea of splitting it into these four sections, not specifically under those headings, but he simply thought that the poems fell naturally into four sections.
Wow.
And suggested that using some terms from Dry Stain Dyking would be a good way of doing it, because of the title of the book and because of the title poem being actually about building a dry stain wall.
So you knew that even quite a while ago.
It's been called this. The manuscript's been called this since I started working on it in 2011. Well, really, the end of 2010. Started picking poems, but the manuscript existed towards the end of 2011. I think it was 12 when John read it over, and he made, as people kindly do when they do this sort of thing, made various pencil notes all over it, and gave me very useful feedback. But the idea of splitting it into these four sections came from John, and I'm very grateful to him, because it the terms that are used in Dry Stain Dyking are very sort of poetic terms. So the four sections of the book fit the topics of the poems really nicely. Footings, poems that are sort of grounded in the life I live here. Tracings, looking back at the past and at different aspects of culture I've lived through. Heartings, the more meaningful and emotional poems in the centre of the book, with some war poems in it there, with some poems about different life experiences. And then copings, the final poems about just the way in which one can work through all these things in life. So those are all genuine Dowking words.
That's amazing.
I've checked this out in a little pamphlet I got all about making dry stained dikes, and there they were. Perfect.
So
I found poem on this waiting to be used.
Well, and it's nice, I think, you know, sometimes when one is approaching a book of poetry, there are different ways to read it. You know, you could keep it by your bedside and just open it up at random and read a poem, or you could start at the beginning and read right the way through. But I think those sections are nice because it gives you permission in a way to sort of read each section as an individual section, you know, as an individual experience as well, which is a nice other way into them.
That's true, I suppose. I hadn't really thought of it about like that in read, so that's a good point, actually, because it's quite a long book, so it makes sense that you can, you know,
I think it's nice.
It gives you a sort of chapter
almost. Yeah, it's fabulous. But it's lovely to see how they work together as well. You do have a series of war poems in this book, or a number of war poems in this book, and you have written about war in the past.
It's a theme that I've been stuck on. It's war poetry that, like, I'm sure many, many poets of my generation got started on this at school when one was taught the war poets, particularly Wilfred Owen, but Siegfried Sassoon, Robert Graves, etc. as well. And that's where my love of contemporary poetry came from, particularly Wilfred Owen, reading those poems. And way back in my almost unimaginable now adolescence, I was, like many, many other adolescent poets, writing poems, but I chose to write about the First World War. It was the time, I mean, we're now in the centenary of the First World War. I'm talking about 50 years since the First World War, 1964, and there was an amazing documentary on television called The Great War, which, being a history obsessive even then, I watched that, and that contributed a lot to my starting writing as well. So it's something that's been with me from way, way back, and it's something I continue to write about. Also partly because of my father's experience in the Second World War. He was right through North Africa in the Desert Campaign, and then up through Italy in the invasion into the south of Europe. And we knew nothing about this when we were kids. He never never said a word about it, other than the fact that he was in the RAF, but he was ground crew, he was an engineer. But he didn't say anything about it other than that he had actually been in the war. And my brother and I were able to play with things like his RAF cap and his desert sunglasses, complete with little leather bits at the side for keeping the sand out and things like that. We had all these things. I used to play with his old ground sheet. It was great to have this thing to use as a cape for playing war games and so on. So they were just artifacts that we'd got used to as kids. And it was only after he died that we discovered a whole lot of things that he'd had a bag of photographs which traced the route through these two parts of the campaign, which I've written about in a poem I could read for you.
I would be delighted.
Called Opening Up the Bag. So I'll dedicate this to my brother, Neil Johnston, and to my late father, Calvert Johnston.
That must have been quite a shocking experience in a way, discovering a whole family history that you...
It was. I mean, we knew he'd done this, but we didn't have any evidence. He never got this out in his time when we knew him as our dad. It was only, you know, through seeing all these actual photographs that we were able to piece together the experience. Well, I was able to piece together as a writer the experience that he'd been through. And this is the poem that I got out of it. Many years after the discovery of this, my dad was only in his 60s when he died, but I was only 25 when he died. This poem was only written about 2-3 years ago, and thinking back about the discovery. Opening up the bag. The kind of bag your mother knocked up for your plimsolls is what this item is, but military khaki, not the regulation colours of your school. And inside, not the gym shoes PE staff demanded for the wall bars and the ropes. Instead, a route through Africa and Italy, grainy in the black and white of contact prints that haven't seen the light, it seems, for years. They track the course of war, and one man's ordered steps along it on the road to home, to his own ration of the nation's thanks. Though dog-eared, creased and curled with age, each snap is an assertion that he made it, while each figure there in all the early frames, but absent as the pile grows lower, is proof that others fell by waysides, heaps of soil and crosses hammered up from scavenged timber mark in maybe half a dozen prints. The last memento of a mate who bought it as the war rolled on. But he's there, balding even at that early age, moustache as clipped and neat as ever, recognisably the father he'd become by making it on through this one-man-med campaign. Its image is unseen while he was just a dad. The war simply a reference point, a presence never more than backstory, a given all his generation understood but wouldn't, couldn't speak of to the next. Till death, his passing in his 60s, opened up this story, loosed off the drawstrings of the bag, let out that younger man, sergeant in his 30s, to march the route again, in picture after picture, the family he lived to make following his train.
That's just so potent, that sense of so many families, I think, have these hidden histories, don't they? That it is often after someone dies or something is discovered and then these stories are revealed from the past.
Well, there's a lot more than that, but you'll have to wait until I
the memoir.
Get my memoir finished. There is a great deal more than that, believe you me. I mean, it's something that's characteristic, I think, of my generation. People born, say, from 1940 through to about mid-50s, there is a big generational gap there, and it's caused not just by the age gap, but by the gap in experience. I could never hope, and would never want to experience the sort of things that my dad's generation went through. So all I can do is try to respond.
Do you think people like your father wouldn't have talked about that because it was painful, or he was protecting his children from that, or it just wasn't the sort of thing one really talked about again?
It's really difficult to know. I mean, he was of he's an older father as well, because I was only 25, he was 68 when he died, so he was older considerably than other fathers of the next generation. So he was born in 1909, and obviously the social mores then were very, very different, and it was very much that old British thing,
stiff upper lip,
you know, don't let the side down, don't give anything away, you know, if you've had problems, just bite your lip and get on with them. And that was something that both my parents were very much prone to. They did not discuss problems, they didn't talk about anything, they just got on with it. And I think that was partly the wartime spirit, you know, the slogans that are now terribly fashionable, keep calm and carry on. I mean, there's a downside to that, because people didn't talk about their problems, so people had psychological problems and bottled them up.
Yeah.
Not that I'm saying my dad did, or my mum, but you know, it was just the way people behaved then, and that's why he wouldn't talk about it.
Yes. Do you feel like your writing about history and family and war is... does that help you to understand these things more, that process of engaging with them?
It definitely does, but I'm not doing it because I'm trying to understand it. I'm doing it simply because the subject matter's there and I'm drawn to it. It's a human experience that I'm trying to capture in the poems, but undoubtedly writing them really does help to you know, understand better and to empathise much, much better.
Mm.
But then the maturity of years does that as well, you know. When I was 25, I was a horrible prig and probably thought my father was a pompous oaf. Now I have a very different view of the man, very different.
How do you... you've mentioned a couple of times, for instance, with the concrete road, that it seems like there's an intensity of subject matter that sparks poems in you. Is that how you find you write? Is it something that strikes you and you think, ah, there's a poem? And I'm curious, do you write every day, or when that spark strikes you?
I believe in inspiration. I'm an inspiration-driven writer, and I can't do this practice of writing every day. I know a lot of people swear by it, and a lot of people believe that just you, whatever you're writing, the act of writing is enough stimulus. It doesn't work like that for me. I'm not sparked off by seeing things like that concrete road I was talking about, or the bag of things my dad left. I'm sparked off by words. It's the words that drive it.
Uh-huh.
The words come, but the words come because I've had sitting in the back burner of my brain some image or something that struck me about something.
Okay.
And it's almost always it's things that drive it. Objects in many cases, just simple objects, right through to this bag of photographs encapsulating a war career or the stuff in the concrete road, and other things like I've written about in this book, such as a bombing raid on Greenock, the riots in Burma, that sort of thing, right through to things like an abandoned railway line in Fife and old tools I inherited from my father-in-law. So it's very often objects that sit in the back of my head that capture my thoughts and imagination, but I can't actually write until the words, usually the first words of a poem, but sometimes a section of poem, which I'll expand in both directions, very occasionally, and it's brilliant when this does happen, the final line, and you can work back, because the final line is always the most difficult, but it's the words that do it, and once I have the words, that's the impetus that will drive me forward, and I have to get a first draft down straight off. Virtually never have I written a bit of a poem and gone back.
Interesting.
Virtually never.
And then do you find once you've got that first draft that you might go back to that and tweak it and
I
edit
go
it?
Back, yeah. I write in pen or pencil, never write straight onto a computer or even a typewriter in the past. I always write first on paper. And usually I will tweak the first draft a bit in my notebook, depending on whether it's my large notebook that I have at home or my small pocket notebook that I carry around with me everywhere, and how much space there is to actually redraft. Sometimes I'll even redraft by hand. Then I type up, and then I work on the typescript, because typing up gives you a sense of the geography of a poem, and you need to know how it looks on the page. That's very important to me as well. And I'll go through up to 20, 30 drafts, sometimes more even.
Do you keep your drafts as people?
I confess I do, yes. I'm not sure why, I just can't bear to throw them away.
Sometimes you need to. You think, oh no, wait, there was that way it was a few drafts back, and if you
I would never throw them away until I've achieved a sort of acceptable finished poem. But even poems are finished, I'm afraid. I stick them all in a cupboard and I keep them all. Well, it should be obvious from my poems that I'm obsessed with the past, I'm obsessed with objects. So if I'm creating objects with my past embedded in them, I'm not going to chuck the bloody things out.
Well, what else would a PhD student be able to research from if not the archive?
I also, when I have finished a poem to my satisfaction, and I can't remember who said, the famous quote that a poem's never finished, it's just abandoned. I agree with that absolutely. You can never be sure. I even tweak poems once they've come out in books. I'm doing a reading with a poem from my last book in a couple of weeks' time. I just noticed if I changed a pronoun in the last line of one poem, it improved it. So I've done that. It's in print now, but too late, but I've changed it for the reading. But when I've finished a poem, I also do a hand version. I have notebooks for finished poems. I copy everything out into my little commonplace books, which I use to keep all my poems in and collect quotes in and note down sort of diary events that I think are particularly significant, like my new book, things like that.
Mm. They do feel very crafted, the poems. I think you definitely get a sense of the music of the lines and the word choice being very exact. But you are famously interested in music and work with musicians, and you have your wonderful group Trio Verso.
Thank you for that, because that's very good that you're appreciating that, because that's one of the things I try to do with my poems, is to to capture a musicality in the words and in the structure of the words.
Well, that's a bit of a musical reference.
Yes.
That song's been going through my head ever since I read.
There are quite a few music poems, specifically music poems, in the book. There's a poem dedicated to the jazz saxophonist Sonny Rollins, called Sonny Rollins on Rollins and the Williamsburg Bridge, set in New York, all about a particular time when Sonny Rollins was in retreat, practicing his art.
Would he really do that? Would he go up on
It's true, thing? This is a true story. It's a totally true story. He went up onto the Williamsburg Bridge for peace and quiet in the middle of New York, and he played sax there for several years to improve his technique.
Can you imagine?
And he's got an album. You could actually get an album of his called The Bridge, which is all the material that he worked on during that period. And there's a poem about Lady Day, Billie Holiday, discovering her as a teenager with a friend of mine, and realising the way her music connected with people's lives through the reaction of his mother to the poems. The reaction of his mother to the songs, they reduced her to tears, which as teenagers we were not really prepared for. And I've written quite a lot of music ones. The one in here that I'll read for you is actually, it's a fantasy, and it has to be a fantasy because I don't think the Beach Boys ever did visit St Andrews. But this is an attempt to sort of imagine St Andrews as a beach resort in California. Well, St Andrews got a huge beach. It could be used for surfing. You can imagine beach parties there. Well, there are beach parties there, but
I was going to say, I've heard of a few parties.
It's true, but I don't think the Beach Boys have ever visited, and I don't think the climate quite matches up to California. But we've just come from a reception for Christine De Luca being inaugurated as the new Marker of Edinburgh. And she read a little poem about Edinburgh in 1965 when she first arrived, and about how po-faced Edinburgh was. Well, I left Edinburgh in 1969 to go to St Andrews as a student, and Edinburgh certainly was an extremely po-faced place, but St Andrews wasn't really any better. So this is set in the St Andrews of that period, in the 60s, when there was a lot of sucking in of cheeks and a lot of disapproval of things. Surf and safari for a small town boy. The best pop is like a rush of lust. Alistair Mackay. The juice coupe threads the dunes back of the sands. Her daddy's car. But he will understand that parties must be seized, she says. Like days, thrown as handmade pots, agreed the way they've signed their surfboards, waxed them down like documents. In this grey town, the sounds of doo-wop only surface from the drains that overflow. The malice of late summer rains determined in their pockmarked progress over sands and shallows, all that acneed skin to mess up every wrung-out joy that they display. Gleaming in convertibles, the Wilsons, Jardine, love, gay in some forgotten sense. The discs stack up, the portable dancette slaps platter onto platter, enough to wind the provost up, his bike a solitary patrol against the shameless pleasure of it all. Awful in his cycle clips, flat cap, he gets around. His face a sucked-in breath of disapproval. Go on, chase the blues away before he gets onto your back. The surf is up. The wind is from the north, but fuck all summer long, this is as good as it will get. The needle hits the groove, love's voice. You paddle out beyond the waves, youth tied on with a cord. She watches you. God only knows holds your reward in supple limbs. You feel the surge. You sing it. Sea rips at your board. She says, sing it one more time for me.
No, you could almost. I feel the music playing all in and by.
Well, I can't remember how many Beach Boys titles in this. About half a dozen Beach Boys titles sneaked into the poem as well.
Oh, I'm going to have to go home and listen.
Not that I'm a huge Beach Boys fan. I love that surf music from my youth, but jazz is my main thing now. And as you were saying, I'm privilege to work with two fantastic jazz musicians, Richard Ingham and Louise Major, in Trio Verso. The quality of Trio Verso really makes it sound like I'm a musician as well. I'm not. I'm a frustrated musician. I adore jazz, love music of many different types. Jazz is my main thing. And I will never be able to play an instrument. I have tried, believe me. Terrible.
I think you play your voice pretty good.
I try. But just being able to do that, to vocalise my own words, but to have the fantastic improvised accompaniment of these two people, it's so fulfilling. It's such fun. I absolutely adore
doing
it.
It's wonderful to listen to.
It's great to be able to get up on stage and just fantasise about, you know, here I am with my jazz band. And it's great.
I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about The Fields of War, which is featuring poems from this book. Is it just this book?
No, that poem that I read a couple of poems back, the one opening up the bag from my dad, that's the opening poem of The Fields of War performance. This is a project that I'm working on with the poet Chris Salt. She's a fantastic poet, fantastic performer. And so we got together basically at the Calendar Poetry Festival last year. I did a presentation of my own war poetry at Calendar. Chris was there and heard that. And we talked a little bit about maybe doing something together. Then she was doing a reading at Shore Poets in Edinburgh. And she read from her pamphlet, which is based on letters from her son who served in Iraq. So it's the pamphlet has quotes from letters and Chris's poems in response to that, and we talked there, took this idea further of how we could combine this. There's a lot obviously going on in 2014 to look back to 1914, so we thought maybe we could do some performances of a joint event. We put together, it's essentially a little theatre show with the two of us taking our own view of warfare for the whole 100 years from 1914 right through to 2014. I read First World War and Second World War poems about Bosnia, about Cyprus, about the Falklands. Chris reads one about Hiroshima, a general anti-war poem, and then she reads the Iraq poems to conclude the events. It's done quite theatrically with, you know, interspersed voices and exchanges between us. I read her son's diaries, she reads the intros to my poems. So we've got a performance coming up at the National Library here in Edinburgh in a couple of weeks' time. And then the next one, we're doing one in the Maltings Theatre in Berwick. And we've got one coming at Aberfeldy and Stirling.
You not only have been so good about collaborating and working with other poets and artists, but you have also done some extraordinary work creating platforms and stages for other poets. And I'm just really, I mean, it's probably could be a whole other podcast where we just talk about these things, but I'm always so impressed. I think it's a very generous act for poets to make these kind of spaces, because it's really the way, one of the main ways to support other poets in getting their work out there. So how did this come about? How did you start the Shore Poets in Stanza?
That's a difficult one, because I'm kind of vague in the past now. I started the Shore Poets basically when I met another Edinburgh-based poet, Ros Brackenbury, who moved to Edinburgh from London. And Ros and I ran into each other at a reading she was doing in Leith, which I just stumbled upon one night. We became friendly. We discussed the fact that there were, in those days, very, very few platforms for live poetry in Edinburgh. We both felt, as I still fundamentally believe, that poetry is what you hear. It's the poems exist in the air, on the voice. What's on the page is notation. And I particularly wanted to try and get some sort of platform on for poetry in Edinburgh that was alternative to what was happening, which at that period back in the early 90s was more academically based. So we wanted a looser poetry and music with in a pub, maybe with some drink and so on. We started off in a gallery in Leith, moved up into the centre of town, and it took off. I haven't been actively involved in Shore Poets for over 10 years now, but it's still flourishing. And in fact, Christine DeLuca, the new Macker, is a member of the current Shore Poets team. So it came from that, really, just a desire to make more live poetry available for an audience. And now it astonishes me that the number of things that are going on in Edinburgh. You could go to a spoken word or poetry event virtually every night in Edinburgh.
That's true.
Absolutely fantastic. That's the way poetry should be experienced first, I believe.
Through performance, through hearing.
I really believe that, yeah. And in fact, very often if I'm wanting to explore a new poet's work, I would much rather explore it by hearing them read first and then go into the text on the page.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. I think that I always remember Michael, I'd heard Michael Longley at the book festival,
yes.
And someone had asked him, what's more important, poetry on the page or poetry when you hear it? And he said, poetry is first oral, I'm going to get my mouth, and second oral, I'm going to get my ear, and then it's written down.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think again it was
absolutely, and just listen to Michael reading. He's a wonderful reader of his work.
Beautiful.
So he's absolutely right. And Michael himself, being a classicist, would point out that if you go back far enough to ancient Greek, there was no distinguishing between the term for poetry and the term for music. They were,
mm-hmm.
or was it song? Anyway, but the two things were perceived as linked very,
mm-hmm.
very closely.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow they've diverged, and poetry is seen as initially a literary form. I don't believe that. I think it's initially an oral form.
And certainly existed before
yes,
writing
absolutely.
Down
it was,
anything
it was
to write
held
down.
Held in the mind.
Yes.
Held in the mind. Precisely.
Yes, and passed on in that
mm.
way. And stanza? That's just
stanza,
another bright
stanza
idea.
Stanza kind of kicked off in a very, very similar way. It was founded when not two, but three poets met. It was a John Burnside reading in St Andrews, and myself and Anna Crowe and Gavin Bowd got together after this and decided that it was time there was another poetry festival in St Andrews. There had been poetry festivals in St Andrews off and on since the 60s. The first one started in 68 by Jay Perini, the American poet who was a student there then. But they've all of these little festivals had lasted a few years and then kind of fizzled out because people had left the area, people had academic careers that absorbed them and they couldn't carry on. The previous one to Stanza was one that was run by Professor Nick Rowe from the School of English. I was actually on the committee of that, which existed for about 5 or 6 years in the early 90s. It was taken over by Douglas Dunn, and Douglas was a huge example to us all, and he really, through this move, proved that there was a viable audience for poetry in St Andrews. He's famous for this big event that he put on in the Younger Hall, the graduation hall, a very large hall, it's a capacity of several thousand, and he filled it for Seamus Heaney, and
okay.
The place was packed out for Seamus Heaney. And that was an inspiration to us as well. So we started fairly small in 1998, and I was going to say it's grown. I'll be honest, we've grown it. We've grown it. We've publicised. We've marketed. We've brought in terrific poets from worldwide. I was director for up until 2010. 2000 till 2010. It's now directed by the wonderful Eleanor Livingston, who is. Growing it even further. It's going from strength
yeah.
to strength, and it's fantastic for me to see as both a founder and the founder who stayed with the festival longer than the others, and to see it continue to grow the way it does.
Mm. It's just always such a special part of the poetry calendar, and I always feel like it's the chance to see all sorts of extraordinary poets you might not otherwise get to see, so I'm very grateful for it. I guess I was thinking about the title of this book and that word work in the title, and it feels like that's another kind of theme that runs throughout the book, the doing and the making and the work of lives. And was that something you felt? Also, I should mention, it's got the most beautiful cover. Is that, how did you find that image?
Well, the cover is a work by the Fife-based artist Will McLean, who's
wow.
actually a Highlander from Lewis. No, wait a minute, I'm not sure he's from Lewis. From the Gaeltacht. Will's a wonderful artist. I'm privileged to have him as a friend. He was very generous in giving me the image from the cover of my last book. I cheekily asked him again for this one.
It's stunning.
He equally generously gave me a cover for this one. It's called Star Chart. But I think of it, the book's called Dry Stone Work. I think of this as maybe some sort of mechanism that a surveyor might use to plot the
route of a
dry stone dike or something like that.
Some sort of tool made of beautiful twigs and a kind of map of some sort.
Well, have a look for his work. I mean, there's not an awful lot online, but he's a fantastic artist. Well worth checking out. But no work and the sort of the hand work of people and people of the past, that again fitting in with this interest in objects and the way an object almost has a pattern of use to it, which can embody the personality of the people that have used it in the past. So as you handle material like that, you're directly in touch. I remember one of the times exploring a place in the south of Crete. An ancient site on a very forgotten bay where there'd been no archaeology, so there was just a few bits of ruinous stone lying around and old broken roof tiles and so on, all from this classical site from maybe 3,500 years ago. Picking up a tile, there was a thumbprint on it. So put your thumb on that, you know, you're in direct touch. So I could end with a poem that deals with these matters, if you like.
I would love that.
Right.
And do you get a copy of this book? We've got it in the library now, and it's published by ARC, and I'm sure you can find it. We'll put a link to it online, but I'm sure you can also find it at bookstores.
Well, you can buy it off my website, so there's an opportunity to purchase on the website as well. And I can even sign it for you if you're interested. Okay, so I'll end up with this poem here. This is based on tools inherited from my father-in-law, all of which were in a pretty shocking state, it has to be said, held together with bits of string and tape, and obviously they'd been very well used. My father-in-law had a motto, which was, "He should be hung that has near contrivance," and he was always somebody who would make do and mend, and things were held together until they finally fell apart. I don't do much work with these tools now. They sit in a drawer and are kind of abandoned, but I can't possibly chuck them out. I did use them in the past. The Thousand Blows. What's done to wood cannot be undone. To steel, abrasives can rub down, a whetstone can restore, and could with time this edge that hasn't seen its like for years. The thousand blows this handle took shivered in the splintered grain, splits so old they've taken on the patina of age, the tally of time spent over chisel, over bench, where cord was little use to bind the stock, damaged by the hefted knock, no more than accident deferred. It's held but would not do for long, this long. As long as steel is dull, the edge unused, the rust grown slowly on the blade, the sweat that soaked into the handle with each blow, glowing in the dim electric light that aids a rummage in the drawer where each one of the thousands has its twin, in other blows, in other tools forgotten as the men who made them sing. Let them lie here, goods no one will get the good of, ends as rough as hands that held them, weary with it all.
Thank you for downloading this Scottish Poetry Library podcast. For further information about the Scottish Poetry Library, visit our website at www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk, follow us on Twitter at @ByLeavesWeLive, and find us on Facebook.